Good afternoon. Welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts in the Bay Area. I'm Angie Coro, very pleased to be sitting in this week for host David LaTalib. David and Niels have put together quite a show for today. I hope you enjoy it. It starts out with a Frameline 44 centerpiece film, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson. That debuts tonight in the Virtual Film Festival. We'll talk to producer Zachary Green. Then a visit with the playwright and executive producer of Manatee on Mars, a new play about autism. Now, that's presented by Remote Theater, which has its own fascinating story. It was born of the pandemic. Finally, our latest installment of Corona Radio Theater. And today, that's another visit with word for word excerpts from our Octavio Solis' memoir, Retablos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Listen to me. Let's try that again. That's all coming up on Open Air here on KALW. Frameline 44 this year is online with its virtual San Francisco International LGBTQ Film Festival. The festival's been going strong since 1977, and it saves its centerpiece designation for its most exciting entries. Front and center this year is The Obituary of Tunde Johnson, the story of a young black gay man coming into his own only to be killed repeatedly and in various scenarios by police. It's a device used to humorous effect in Groundhog Day, but I promise you, all the similarities end there. This is no comedy. It's an innovative, intriguing film examining all the weight Tunde's identities and struggles to grow settle on his young shoulders. With me to discuss The Obituary of Tunde Johnson is the film's producer, Zachary Green. Zachary, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm so glad to have you on board. I do want to correct briefly something I said. This is online now through September 27th, but the folks at Frameline are strongly suggesting that our listeners watch it tonight at 8:30 because there's a subsequent Q&A featuring you, the director, and the writer. So let's get that out there to be sure. I have to tell you, watching this movie, it's something that has your heart in your throat any number of times, but it's very engaging in terms of plot, in terms of the standard, the gold standard, what's going to happen next. And I credit a great deal of that to two things, and that would be the storyline and the performance of the lead actor. Let's talk about that storyline first, because that comes from a very, very young man. Tell us about him.
That's correct, yes. The writer's name is Stanley Kalu. And how we found out about him and were able to find his script is actually I co-founded and run a screenplay competition called the Launch Million Dollar Screenplay Competition. And it was put into place in the first year in 2018. We got a little over 500 submissions from 208 schools in 37 countries.
Wow.
And we narrowed that down to the top eight people that we just thought these scripts were just incredible. And we gave them a combined $100,000 in education grants. The top three got repped at an agency and a management company. And the number one screenplay we promised to produce for at least $1 million. Mm-hmm. So that's how we found out about Stanley's screenplay. He's from Nigeria. He's lived in seven or eight different sub-Saharan African countries, moving around with his family, and wrote the screenplay when he was only 19 years old. It got to us when I think he just turned 21. So just an incredible screenplay, and we were so excited to make it as our first winning competition movie.
How much does this film reflect his own experience as a gay man?
I'm not exactly sure how he identifies, just to be clear on that. But mm-hmm. Essentially, the story came from you grew up in Africa. So there really wasn't any racism in any of the countries that he lived in because he's black. But unfortunately, a lot of African countries just look down upon the LGBTQ+ community. And I'm sure we have all read or seen horrific things that happen there.
Yes.
And then when he came to America for the first time, when he was 18 to attend the screenwriting program at USC, things flipped on him. His LGBTQ friends were all okay to be who they wanted to be, as the way it should be, but he experienced racism for the first time. He experienced being profiled by the police for the first time. And every time that he went and watched the news at night, he saw people that looked like him, black bodies being abused, being murdered, being killed, all those horrific things. So it felt like he was just in a loop of watching this happen all the time. So that sort of was the basis of the story.
You know, there are several things that I didn't expect about the film, things that I found to be unusual when you're talking about an urban black man in the standard Hollywood depiction. He's not in upper class, very rich, very settled family. He doesn't necessarily have compassionate, accepting parents. He tends to be shown in a milieu that's, you know, his black friends, his black teachers, you know, black people on the street that he talks to. This is nothing like that. This is a completely different setting. The parents who support him when he comes out to them, there's so much that's unexpected here.
I'm really glad that you picked up on that. And this goes to the genius of Stanley. He's 23 now. And I don't know where he gets his talents from. I mean, he's ridiculously smart. He's getting a download from somewhere. But he purposefully did that. He wanted to portray a black, young black man in a black family in a different light than is traditionally shown in sort of the generic way that Hollywood normally does. So Tunde comes from a great family. His parents are, you know, upper middle class. There's one scene in the film when he's talking to his therapist about halfway through the film, which I really identified with, and that saying that, you know, he should be happy. He comes from a nice family. He lives in a nice home. He has parents that are supportive. He drives a nice car, but he's not. Mm-hmm. So it's really to kind of turn the generalization and the stereotype that Hollywood sort of has to black people in films and turn it on its head and really depict a true sense of it.
Let's talk about Steven Silver, who has that main role. And I know he's already got a resume. He's most prominent in 13 Reasons Why, but he feels like a find. I mean, for something of a film that settles entirely on his shoulders, he's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, Steven is just an incredibly gifted actor. We were insanely lucky to find him. We had a wonderful casting director by the name of Barbara Fiorentino, who I believe actually did cast him in 13 Reasons Why as well. And so he was one of the people that we initially saw coming in, and he just blew us away with his performance in the casting room, and we knew that we had found our Tunde. And on set, he was just incredible. He's such an emotional young man, and really dug deep to find the emotion in the character, and we think just portrayed him brilliantly.
When you approached him with the role, once he had won the role, what did he personally bring to this, and what could you see him learning as he went along?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, Steven just brought his experiences in life to the film. He is an amazingly trained actor, so he was able to sort of crawl in the mind of Tunde. And I think one of the really cool things about the film competition that I run is that we didn't just coin Stanley the winner and take his script and go make the movie. Mm-hmm. Stanley was there every step of the process through the casting. He was on set every day. He became very friendly with the actors and worked with our director, Ali Leroy, to really make sure that the actors all knew who their characters were. So Steven and Stanley spent a lot of time together talking about Tunde, so Steven could really, really embody him. And throughout the process, I think, you know, we all learned a lot being on set. It was a very short shoot. It was only 16 days because of budgetary restrictions that we had. But Steven just, I think, really grew as a person and has become a great friend. We all have formed this little great group in the last couple of years of people from the film. And he's just a really good guy.
It's another interesting thing about the structure that the coming out of the main character to his parents, Tunde talks to them in the beginning. It's not something that you build up to, and that's the big climax of the film. It's almost matter of fact, and it happens very early in the film. So we see Tunde established as someone who has that supportive home and has the personal gumption to come out. And as the movie evolves, we see that the young man he is very much in love with and has an ongoing relationship with doesn't have that kind of gumption. And that's a lot of the angst in the film.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, Stanley really set it up in a genius sort of a way. He knew he wanted to do a loop similarly to Groundhog Day or Edge of Tomorrow, but not make it so overt, to make it the indie way. So by showing Tunde coming out right at the beginning, coming out to his parents, showing that he has supportive parents, and that now it's time to go over to his boyfriend's house to come out to his dad, and having what happens to restart the loop again, we just really wanted to put it in the audience's mind what was happening at the beginning, and then hopefully be able to follow that throughout the loops throughout the film.
Let's talk about the mechanism of having him wake up. Tunde wakes up every day having just been shot or otherwise killed by police the day before. Now, is he carrying knowledge of that previous event into the next day?
You know, I think that's a little bit up for the audience members to really think about and internalize to see what they feel. But, you know, the way that Stanley, I think, envisioned it and Ali masterfully directed it was that, you know, it's the indie version of Groundhog Day. So Bill Murray in Groundhog Day knows that he's stuck in those days. In this version, Tunde's not really sure. He has some mental health issues, which we think are really important to talk about, just in general, but specifically in this film. He also has some addiction issues. He abuses Xanax. So while he's trying to moderate himself on the medication and taking too much and taking too little, he's really not sure what is real and what's really happening. So that loop that continues to go on, I think that he's a little bit aware of it, and you can see in the film through Steven's performances as Tunde, there's little things that he kind of picks up on is like, wait, is this real? Is this not real? So we just, it was purposefully to try to keep a little bit subtle.
I'm talking to producer Zachary Green. The film under discussion, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson. You'll find that online right now at frameline.org, part of this year's festival, Frameline 44. When we watch him interact with his friends, I found it interesting his relationship to women, because there is one young woman who is the primary role in his life, and everyone else is sort of background. And we watch their relationship evolve differently. Every day he wakes up with a slightly different relationship with this young woman, and it goes from compassionate and supportive to more and more strained. Why is that?
That's a great question. I think that Tunde, you know, unfortunately doesn't have a lot of friends. He's a little bit introspective. He is not out as in terms of being gay to his friends. He has just come out to his family. So Tunde sort of is a little bit reserved and stays to himself. But his best friend is this girl, Marley, who they've known all of his life. Even at the beginning of the film, the mom makes a reference that the two of them should maybe get together. Maybe they should date. So when the loops keep happening, and Tunde is trying to figure out stuff, yes, his relationship with Marley changes because he's feeling more and more protected over his relationship with Soren. Mm-hmm. So it has this interesting arc going from friends to sort of being strained. And then, you know, towards the end, there's a bit of a compassionate gesture and some closure with their relationship as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the role of the adult figures. We have the parents who are very supportive. We have the father of his love interest who essentially is a Fox News kind of guy. I mean, nobody says Fox News, but he's a Fox News kind of guy. Talk about juxtaposing the young man he's in love with and that influence in the same family, because that takes a toll on the young man in question.
It definitely does. And, you know, once again, to pay accolades to Stanley, he just really was a genius in terms of how he came up with that role of Alfred O'Connor, this sort of Fox News-esque type of a person, to have sort of the contradictory roles of who his son is. His son is closetedly gay, and who he is this sort of Fox News type talking head. But I think, you know, when you really watch the film, as I hope a lot of your listeners do, and the people in the San Francisco area log on and check it out at the film festival, Frameline, you'll see that there is compassion within the father. And that's the way we wanted to show him. We didn't want him to be, you know, a complete, you know, right-wing person who doesn't have feelings and isn't able to really understand his family. We wanted to portray him with a little bit of compassion, because we do believe that deep down inside, regardless of who you are, hopefully there is some compassion in there.
You wanted to talk a little more about the mental health aspects, and I do know that statistically and culturally, mental health care is very different for non-white Americans. So how does this play out in the film?
Yeah, it definitely is different. And I think, you know, one of the other incredible things about the film is that it takes on so many different things. It takes on police brutality. It takes on racism, LGBTQ issues, mental health issues, addiction issues. So it's very much a social-based film. And mental health is, you know, a cause very important to me, because I just think that regardless of who you are in this country, you deserve access to not only good health care, but good mental health care. I struggle with mental health. I have depression issues. I have anxiety issues. And that was one of the things that really sort of drew me to originally when I read the screenplay. But people just need to be able to get help. And we wanted to portray that in the film with Tunde being able to talk to his therapist, to his psychiatrist, be able to get medication if need be, and to sort of break the stigma a little bit that, there's certain demographics within this country that feel there's a stigma to get mental health and there's a stigma put on it. And we wanted to try to help break that.
That's an interesting role for Tunde to have to play. On the one hand, he's a whole person within the film. He's a whole character going through what he's going through. And at the same time, because he's the only person of color who's prominent in the film besides his parents, he also is something of, an emblem. He stands for non-white Americans trying to get some mental health care, trying to treat themselves to what's available.
Definitely. And that was a very thoughtful thing that Stanley did and Ali did throughout his directing, is that it was very purposeful to have Tunde sort of stand out, to really be the only Black character, like you said, besides his parents, because that's the way that Stanley was feeling when he came here to America, that he sort of felt like he was on this island and people looked at him differently. So he just wanted to portray that within the other characters that he wrote within the film, and to be able to, what's interesting is that I'm a 46-year-old Jewish kid from the Midwest. So this isn't my story to tell. Yeah. As a producer, I'm a facilitator, and I tried. We found Stanley. We have Ali as an incredible, amazing director on board as our captain, leading this thing forward. We had an incredible editor in Shannon Baker Davis. We had the bassist of the Rolling Stones, Daryl Jones, do the score for us. Mm. So we really wanted to try. We did it, the producer. Put it into the hands of the storytellers that knew this experience. So we got very lucky with that.
I have to let you go shortly, but before I do, I want to ask you about one line in the film that really stood out. And this actually was from a little clutch of women. Marley, the woman young woman we've already discussed, is part of that clutch of women. She has landed a role. She's a budding actress, and she's landed a role. And one of her friends tries to congratulate her with a small box of chocolates, and they all get slapped away from that box of chocolates. And Marley says, "We're all hungry." And, of course, that's a glance to the eating disorders that are common among young girls. But I also think it speaks to the entire cast.
Yeah, definitely. Stanley, once again, coming from Africa, and coming to USC in Southern California at the age of 18 and having those experiences, his life was turned upside down. He came from a very great family, a strong family, a big family back in Africa. He grew up with great education. He didn't really want for much. So he led a great life there. And then coming here, everything was flipped on its side. He saw things that he had never seen before in Africa. So I think that definitely was a nod to some of the eating disorder issues and the body dysmorphic disorder issues that people in America have, especially young people, due to all the social media complexes and especially people in Southern California.
Yes, that's its own area. I want to thank you so much, Zachary Green, both for joining me and for the film. I really endorse that people see it. It's moving and it's intriguing.
Thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate you taking a watch of the film and getting the word out.
Oh, absolutely. Zachary Green, The Obituary of Tunde Johnson, is online through September 27th. Tonight's version at 8:30 has a Q&A with the director, the writer, and producer Zachary Green himself. You can find that information at frameline.org. We're going to scoot on over to a staged reading right after this on Open Air. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Angie Querer, sitting in for David LaTulipe. So we scoot on over to the stage, the virtual stage, as conceived and executed by Remote Theater. Remote was born of the pandemic. It's a platform for staged readings beamed out to theater lovers who are currently locked out of their favorite venues. And it's turning into something of its own art form. There is only one reading scheduled for its next production, the one we're about to talk about. That is Manatee on Mars, a new play about autism by playwright Tanya Schaefer. She is with me on the line, along with executive producer Philippa Kelly. We'll let you know about how you can watch that in just a moment. But first, I want to welcome you both. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's very good to have you. Let me acquaint people with you. Tanya Schaefer is a playwright who has won awards for her work. She is also author of the acclaimed travel memoir, Somebody's Heart is Burning, A Woman Wanderer in Africa. She's had work produced by Berkeley Rep Theater, Theater Works, San Diego Rep Theater, and a contemporary theater. Her musical, The Fourth Messenger, enjoyed sold-out runs in Berkeley, Taiwan, and the New York Music Festival. Philippa Kelly is resident dramaturg for the California Shakespeare Festival and at Napa Shakes. Her other credits include the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. She's chair and professor of English at the California Jazz Conservatory. And how do you fit all this in? She's also a professor at various UC campuses, including Berkeley and Santa Cruz. I'm amazed, Philippa, you've got any time to talk to us.
It's an honor to be able to talk with you.
I'm glad to have you. Let's talk about just the concept of the title, The Vision of the Manatee. Lumbering, sweet, kind of bloated, gentle creature of the sea. Where did the manatee come from, Tanya?
Well, it's kind of a funny story because actually for a lot of this play's development, the title was Squirrel Jokes. Because the character of the 12-year-old boy who's at the center of this, his name is Cody, and he's obsessed with cartoons, and he sees the world through the lens of his favorite cartoon. And for a long time, when I was first writing it, I had just stuck in SpongeBob as his favorite cartoon. And Squirrel Jokes is an episode of SpongeBob that deals with discrimination and the pain of prejudice. And so that was what I was working with for a long time. But then at some point, I started to think about rights and things. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to throw in my own cartoon. I'm going to make up my own cartoon because then I'll have the freedom to do whatever. I can quote it. I can make up the whole world. And so I started to, I actually Googled like funny animal names, and up came Floaty Potato as a name for a manatee. And I was like, that's it. Floaty Potato, that's perfect. And so Floaty Potato became Cody's favorite cartoon. And then I was just brainstorming episodes. And I thought, what if there's an episode where Floaty Potato goes to Mars? And there, you know, back in the ocean, people kind of tease him because he moves slowly. But on Mars, everybody's moving slowly. In space, everybody's moving slowly. So there's a place where he feels comfortable. So that sort of grew into the title of the show.
Can you talk about the challenge of depicting autism in a spoken word production?
Well, I'm depicting Asperger's, you know, which is a high-functioning type of autism. So Cody is very highly verbal, and we are seeing the actors in this reading. So a lot of it is in his speech, in what he says and how he says it. Mm-hmm. And we have a young actor in this role who's very gifted. He isn't on the spectrum himself, but he does have some other challenges, and he really gets it. And I think, you know, just in those sort of ways of being very focused on one thing at a time, I think the spectrum traits come out pretty clearly.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about, I don't know if it's fair to call them the villains of the piece, but the Briars are trying to get Cody out of their daughter's public school. That's a very controversial area because some parents feel like if you have to, quote unquote, slow the class down to follow someone who has special needs, you're depriving the other children. Is that the Briars' take on it?
No, actually, Cody, the boy who's on the spectrum, is very academically gifted. They want to get him out because he bit their daughter.
Ah.
And their daughter, Sonia, has been Cody's best friend since preschool. But as he got older, the mom, Sonia's mom, Catherine, started to have a problem with Cody. She's got a lot of worries about her own daughter's social skills, and she felt like with her daughter hanging out with Cody, she was learning a lot of inappropriate behaviors. And so she's been trying for a few years, and the play jumps back in time to different stages in their childhood. Mm-hmm. And she's been trying for a few years to separate them. And Cody occasionally, when he gets really overwhelmed, will act out in some way. And so in the instance that sort of kicks off the action of the play, it's a game of capture the flag. And Sonia like reaches in front of his face to grab this flag from him, and he bites her. And that's the incident that kind of sets off the family is like, okay, that is it. We've had enough. We're writing letters to everyone from the school board on down. And so that's, and I'm trying to depict it in a way where you can see their point of view. It's mm-hmm. a big deal if someone bites your child, but you also, you see both sides, hopefully.
Right. This is Tanya Schaefer. She's the playwright for Manatee on Mars, which is what we're talking about right now. I want to move it over to Philippa Kelly, who's producing the play. And Philippa, I know that what we're looking at now is the 30th anniversary of the ADA. Tell me what this staged reading, what the content brings to that anniversary.
Well, Angie, I think that one of the things I've been thinking about, just to put it a little bit more broadly, and it's something that I was thinking about when writing the Playbill article, is that we think of, so the ADIA Act might be put right now in context with the fires that have been burning all over California. And for me, they're not just fires. They're metaphors for the way that anger and panic have been ignited over abortion, immigration, and I think also including issues of neurotypicality, how much space and time are neurotypical people taking up in the system. And so I think that this just really speaks to the fundamental human yearning to grow and to evolve and to refuse to have our bodies or our birthplaces, our neurotypicalities dictate our futures. And I feel like at the moment there are matches being put all over the place to fear, and that we have to really remember what the ADA Act has fought for and continues to fight for, that we have to really look at that fear and panic that is so easy to ignite, and to just remember the values of human democracy mm-hmm. that I think theater is constantly bringing into focus. And to me, theater, most importantly, is all about the issue of what democracy is and means. Sorry, that sounds a bit preachy, but I do just feel so strongly about it.
No, not at all. We have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask you about the art of the staged reading online, as opposed to with a theater, where you at least can have some lighting, some sort of set or idea of a set. Tell me what is gained by bringing something to a staged reading that is online only.
Tanya, shall I answer that,
or if you want to? I have thoughts, but
yeah, you go first. You go first.
And we're down to about 90 seconds, by the way.
Well, there's a few silver linings. One is we have actors from all over the country, but in terms of we're playing with what Zoom has to offer. We have backdrops. We have music underscoring original music for this reading by Rindy Eckert, by the way, who is amazing. Mm-hmm. And we can have actors and audience from all over the country. So that's a silver lining. You want to add something, Philippa?
Oh, just to say, we've got also not just Rindy, but remarkable actors, Catherine Castellanos, Anna Ishida. Gosh, I mean, and the young man who plays Cody, they just blow my head off. As a dramaturg, I'm just so awed.
Well, I thank you both so very much. And I want to point people to the Remote Theater website. It's remote.theater. If you click on upcoming events, you will find out about Manatee on Mars, and you can register right there with the link that they provide. We cannot leave, of course, without hearing the theme music from Floaty Potato. So while I thank both of you, Tanya Schaefer and Philippa Kelly, break a leg with that reading of Manatee on Mars.
Thank you, Angie.
So good to have you both. All right. Floaty Potato, here we go.
Who knows why the blue whale's blue? Floaty knows, floaty knows. Who knows why the right whale's right? Floaty knows, floaty knows.
And for the rest of that, you're going to have to tune in to Manatee on Mars. I'm Angie Carter, sitting in for David Lotteleep on Open Air today. One of my favorite features of Open Air, and I have no doubt yours as well, is the landmark Corona Radio Theater, which brings you audio work from many of the theater venues. Their doors are closed, but they're producing fantastic work in the meantime. I know you are familiar with Word for Word, which has a long history in Bay Area theater, and I'm so proud to bring them back. We're going to hear three chapters from Octavio Solis's memoir, That's Retablo. So settle in and give a listen to that.
Before we begin the reading, we recognize that we come to you from unceded lands of indigenous peoples and fully acknowledge
the Ramaytush Ohlone.
The Ama Mutsun.
Chechenyo.
The Southern Paiutes.
The Kelma, Shasta, and Athapascan peoples.
The Lenni Lenape.
And now our first chapter, Retablos.
This is me in my old room, unpacking my bags on the bed I slept in more than 30 years ago, hearing my mother titter at something on the TV while my dad is stirring the caldo de pollo on the stove. He blurts out something crude in Spanish, and now both of them are roaring, big as life, filling the house with horsey laughter. Then it hits me. This is how one of them will cry when the other dies. I look out the window, and I'm 13 all over again, getting ready for school. A polar front blew in all the way down from Canada and locked us in an overnight freeze and didn't even have the manners to leave us any snow. Just the chill air and ice on the power lines. But as I come down the hall for my breakfast, I see my sister standing outside the maid's room, snarling something to herself. I ask her what happened, and she says, the birds are dead. What? The birds are dead, she says again. I look in the room, and I see the maid, this young Mexican girl of 20 we hired to watch the house and cook food for us while my parents are at work. I see her sitting on her bed with her face in her hands. Sobs and the words, perdón, perdón, are slipping through her fingers. While she wipes her snot on her sleeve, I look past her at the cage where my mom's canaries are supposed to be perched. But they're not there. I come closer and find them both balled up and lifeless on the newspaper floor of the cage. They were old, their yellow feathers faded white, inherited from my grandmother when she moved to Fresno, only now they are dead. My sister says the maid left the window open and they froze. They couldn't take the cold. She should have known. Now look at them, she says. I'm about to ask where mom and dad are, but then I hear them laughing in their room. Why would they be laughing? I cross the hall and open the door, which is weird because they hardly ever close the door in the morning once they're up. And there they are. sitting on the bed next to each other, hands on their brows, crying so boisterously it sounds like they're busting at the seams at some practical joke. It's unnerving. I've never seen them wailing like this, bent over and shaking, their mouths contorted, bawling like children. I've seen my mom cry a few times, but never like this, and never my dad, who's not the kind of man inclined to such displays of emotion. For a pair of old birds, no less. There's something ancient about the way their wails change them, even give the room a different light. I think this is a holy moment, and close the door and leave them to their searing, sacred laughter. That's how they come, these memories, like a set of retablos, votive images painted on old beaten tin, marked with the mystery of being, with acts of transgression recorded for those who need to remember. That's what revisiting El Paso is like for me, like walking into a retablo with a rusty surface for a sky and misremembered family and friends for saints and supplicants, and the lost distilled moments of my border past for miracles. They come to me at the strangest times, as if to remind me that I have lived this much because of them.
And now, El Judío.
I don't even know what Judío means. I thought it was his name.
El Judío.
My dad would say to my mom.
Ahí viene el Judío.
Here comes the Jew. But what is a Jew? I never saw one before. I never heard that word before except in reference to Christ, King of the Jews. I thought it meant he was like Jesus. Three of my friends are named Jesus.
Jesus!
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 And they aren't as half as good as the one in the Bible by a long shot. In fact,
one of them shoots birds out of the mimosa tree with his BB gun for the pleasure of it.
And that seems completely the opposite of Jesus. But something about the way my parents say the words
El Judío.
El Judío.
Makes him seem special and sanctified. A man with the kind of spiritual dimension that demands his name be uttered in hushed tones.
The Jew is coming today.
Have you got enough for the Jew?
El Judío is at the door.
One morning, I'm watching cartoons on the TV, and the picture is flipping like crazy, and the vertical hole doesn't work, and my bladder is telling me to march in place before I pee myself in my pajamas. I hear
a knock on the door,
and I open it. Standing real close to the screen door is a tall, ruddy-faced man wearing a golf shirt with some design on the pocket, and at the base of his corpulent neck is a gold chain with a little star on it. He runs his hand through his short reddish hair
and good-humoredly asks, ¿Está papá?
My mom and dad are in the bedroom
reading the paper
while my brothers and my sister
fight over
the comics!
All of them sprawled on the same bed in what is our Sunday morning ritual. But out here, it's me and the man's
benevolent smile.
Huh. I like his watch, gleaming like a holy relic. I like his blue eyes,
squinting against the sun,
to peer into the dark of our house. I tell him to wait, and I turn around and shout over the TV, Mom, Dad, El Judío!
He blinks and blanches a little, never letting the smile teeter off his face.
And then I see my mom
come rushing out
to grab me by the wrist and pull me
into the kitchen
with a mortified look. Then my dad,
yanking his pants on and counting out some cash,
takes my place at the door.
a few words.
And a couple of bills are exchanged.
My dad.
Ending the whole thing with an earnest and apologetic, gracias.
Both of them incapable
of letting their eyes meet.
Don't ever call him that.
They tell me.
That's not his name.
His name is Señor Rubinsky. You got that? Malcriado.
But that's what you call him, I protest. I hear you calling him the Jew all the time.
That's none of your business.
They fire back.
¿Entiendes?
It turns out that David Rubinsky has loaned my dad some money.
To get him through our tough times. He's borrowed money from him for Christmas, too.
So we can get the bikes.
We plead.
And pray for.
In fact, Señor Rubinsky has given countless low-interest loans to the many struggling Mexicans in the greasy spoon business and beyond. The local banks.
Don't trust
our dads much during these recession days.
Why should they when these so-called unaccountables might just default and disappear over the border?
The loans of El Judío are the difference between making the house payment or not, buying groceries or not, getting new clothes for school or not. Whatever they say behind his back, their gratitude for his service is deep and authentic. He's well regarded among these families. When he dies, they will come to his funeral. Their cars lined up for miles to pay their respects to him.
It's ironic that all my varied and valued experiences with Jewish people began with the most pernicious stereotype. But we were stereotypes then, too. Poor backwater Mexicans who had to borrow against their own futures to realize them. The following week, he's at the door again. This time he's wearing a paisley tie over a damp white shirt. I meet him at the door and politely say, Mr. Rubinsky?
His ruddy complexion turns redder still.
And he looks at me like he's stung more by this salutation than by what I said the week prior.
But then he pulls up his chin.
And confers on me.
The thinnest, drollest smile. Tell your papa that El Judío is at the door.
In the following chapter, the older Octavio will be played by Gendel Hernandez, and the younger Octavio will be played by Eddie Flores. And now, La Migra.
That's what we call them. That's how I have always known them. La Migra is a derogatory term, but we don't even think of it like that. It's just what they are. Ever since we moved into the lower valley, the green and white cruisers of the Border Patrol have been everyday fixtures in our lives. In the early days, there were older guys
who take their jobs in stride. They ride on patrol like hired cowboys roping in the errant dogies.
Or maybe more like Texas Rangers.
Patrolling the wild frontier. They know a large portion of the migrants will slip through their net, and they know many of those they catch will be back through the fence in a matter of days. They're philosophical about their mission. What's the harm in a few mojados coming through? Don't we need the manpower anyway?
Then, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a new breed of officer. Stern, all-American types.
Ex-soldiers who got their asses kicked in the jungles of Vietnam and now look to settle that score with these wetbacks and their smuggled Mary Jane. They take the job seriously. Consider themselves a cut above the average city cop. What they do is harder and makes a bigger difference in the complicated world of La Frontera.
That's my take on them, anyway. I start noticing something else in the early 70s, though. Maybe it was always there and I just didn't see it. Or maybe it was a result of the recession and the lack of good-paying jobs. Suddenly, here are more Chicanos manning the vans and cruisers.
The iron in the faces.
The edge in the eyes.
It's all the same, only now the faces and eyes
are brown.
Brown.
The badges say
Marquez.
Armendariz.
Luhan!
Some are even rougher than the Anglo counterparts. It doesn't matter that their parents probably came over the same river with the same intention. One generation is all it takes to keep the past and the legacy of their migration at bay.
They're American now, and this is how they show it.
We're used to them.
How they slow down.
Whenever we're outside drinking Cokes by our bikes.
The officer in his aviator sunglasses
looks us over, scouring our skinny bodies
for the one thing
that marks us
as foreign.
Kino and I point to each other and mouth the words, "Take him! Take him!" My sister takes exception, though.
She thinks the border cop is checking her out, and she's probably...
Right.
But the fact that he's even scrutinizing us this closely is disturbing.
His look lingers just long enough
to make us feel like strangers to ourselves. All the mojaditos that we generally scowl at when we spy them tramping restlessly past our house, he's consciously connecting them to us. We're nothing like them, we've conditioned ourselves to say.
We're legal, born on this side.
But the border cop with his steady gaze
is telling us with his look that the distinction is very thin.
Thin as the lenses on his aviators.
Thin as a line on a map. This day,
I am waiting for the bus to take me downtown to see a movie. The bus stop is just across the street from my house.
The border patrol comes up the street and stops right at the curb.
It's that Mexican officer again, and he's wearing the same reflective shades. His partner is this white guy who looks like he's been badly sunburned. Both of them are giving me...
a once-over.
That makes me nervous. It's the Mexican who talks to me.
You seen anybody go by here lately?
No.
Anyone wearing a red tee?
No.
You're wearing a red tee.
I look down at myself and look at the red t-shirt with the lettering of some band I used to think was bitchin'.
Where you from, kid? He asks.
Here.
Where?
America.
Where do you live?
Right there. I point at my house.
What's the address?
I recite it for him like my life depends on it. Then he does something unexpected.
He removes his shades.
And asks me.
¿Hablas español?
Now I'm trapped. I want to say no, even if it's a lie. Because to admit that I speak Spanish would put me in the other guy's red tee. Just like that. He's made me ashamed of my original tongue, forced me to deny my father's language and thereby deny my father and his fathers before him. And the crazy thing about it is this man is using that very same Spanish against me. There's only one thing I can say. A little.
¿Quieres pasar tus días allí?
What?
You know what I said.
No, sir. He smirks at my lie and looks me
right in the face. Do you want to spend your days over there?
I'm an American, sir.
Barely. Where are you going?
The movies. In my peripheral vision, I sense my mom at the front door.
And the white officer nudges his partner,
who puts on his aviators
and tells me
to keep an eye out for a mojado with a red t-shirt.
Which is what I see reflected in the lenses.
If you spot him, you call us, okay?
These guys are the butts of our jokes. Now they have me shaking all over. They say,
have a good day.
Have a good day.
And drive on down the street.
The bus comes right after they leave. And I go to my James Bond double bill at the Palace Theater downtown. And the whole time I'm watching the screen, I am hating these men and thanking them the same time. Because they're right. I am the guy in the red tee. I am him. and he is me.
And that's word for word. I hope you enjoyed that reading from Retablos by Octavio Solis. And I'm Octavio Solis. And I'm so glad to have him with us to go into that a little further. This is all based on Retablos, stories from a life lived along the border. And if what you heard intrigues you, that is in release from City Lights Books. Octavio Solis, welcome.
Thank you very much, Angie. It's good to be here.
I have to ask you what it sounds like to your ears to participate aloud in what for you was the written word to this point?
Well, it was actually kind of astonishing because I never meant for this to ever find its way to the stage. The reason I wrote it as prose is I didn't want to write a play and stage it in a way that then would involve all these other artists trying to shape and form my ideas. But when it fell into the hands of Word for Word, it just felt right because they take the literature as written and without cutting a word, they find a way to stage it. And my past history with them and my history in seeing all their work just made me feel like that my book would be in the right hands with this company.
You know, it's interesting. Your experience with theater is so, so deep. And for those who aren't familiar, your works have been produced at Center Group Theater, Mark Taper Forum. I mean, you can't get credentials higher than that. South Coast Rep, the Magic Theater, Cal Shakes, Yale Rep Theater, Oregon Shakespeare. It's just interesting to hear with a resume this deep in the world of theater that the idea of bringing this to the stage wasn't your first intuitive idea.
No, not at all. I wanted to make this completely personal. I wanted to, if there was going to be anybody helping me shape and work with this, it would be one editor. That's really all I wanted. Now, I had some other readers before who would read some of the stories and offer advice, but generally it stayed very close to the heart. I didn't even consult my own family very much because I know that every family member has their own perspective, their own view of our history, our upbringing. And if I muddied the waters with getting everyone's view, then it wouldn't become my personal journey. And I wanted it to be my journey.
Tell us about the Retablo paintings.
The Retablos, I found them once. The very first time I saw them, I was in my early 30s, and I found them in a junk shop. After buying one of them, I did some research on it because I just found the image really interesting. The images involve some kind of breach, a kind of injury or illness, or it could be even the village pig dying. But there is some kind of calamity that happens within a family or a community that is then depicted in a picture and that they paint very crudely on a piece of tin with words describing at the bottom what the event happens. And then it also contains an image of the holy, of the sacred, some saint, or it could be the Virgen de Guadalupe, whoever that person offers their orisons to, in order to be saved or to find some kind of atonement or salvation. And then at the end of it, when the prayer is answered, at the very bottom, it offers that thanks to that particular saint. So it's like a little postcard to God, thanking God or the divine for their intercession, for their help. And I found them really wonderful because they felt to me like the very earliest forms of flash fiction.
Oh my God, that's wonderful.
I know, they're really special, and they operate on both a very simple level, like somebody's sick and or someone's lonely or someone's about to get attacked, and then it rises to the metaphysical and the metaphorical. So there's all these levels that are playing at once in it, and I just felt like if I structure my stories according to that, to those paintings, those simple folk paintings, then I can craft them in a way that feels like something more than just a short story.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the persistent vision of the border. In El Paso, even when you have, you know, Mexicans who are legitimately in the country, even Mexican Americans, just that constant presence of the border, it shows up in El Judío, which isn't even really about the border per se. It's about a loan from a man who's coming to collect, Señor Rubinsky. And let me just read this tiny excerpt. Señor Rubinsky has given countless low-interest loans to the many struggling Mexicans in the greasy spoon business and beyond. But it talks about how, why should they make the loans when these so-called unaccountables might just default and disappear over the border? And, of course, the latter part of it, all about the border officer, is centered completely on the border reality. That must have just been on your mind constantly, at least subconsciously, through your entire upbringing.
It was, especially because we lived only a half a mile away from the Rio Grande. So we were at ground zero in the battleground of the immigration issue, the immigration story. So we saw Border Patrol cruisers constantly driving up and down our street. We saw undocumented peoples come by at any hour of the night or day, walking, and we could always tell by their walk, by their gait, that they had just crossed over. They usually carried a bag where they carried their wet clothes, and we could see them making their way. So they were a constant reminder to us, even though we considered ourselves fully American, they were a constant reminder to us of where we came from and what, how thin that line, that border really is. When we see that, you know, we're as legal as those Border Patrol agents, but we should be identifying, and we did identify as much with the undocumented who were from the other country. Because we ourselves were all first generation. My parents were from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And my father himself was a quote-unquote illegal alien and almost was deported back to Mexico. He now has full American citizenship and is ashamed of those chapters in his life. But I take great pride in asserting that part of that history because it's part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Talk about, we just have a few seconds left. Can you talk about the idea of having to talk to the border cop to deny my language, to deny my father? Let's go out on that note.
Wow. Well, you know, it's really, it was a very interesting encounter because the Border Patrol put me in a position of like trying to admit that I could speak in Spanish. And if I spoke to him back in Spanish, then it would mark me consciously or unconsciously on some level as an illegal alien. And I didn't want to go there because I didn't want to be, you know, accosted or taken in, run in by them. And I knew that to speak it would cause that, but to not speak it would be to also abjure and turn away the people that my father represented, the whole journey that my father took to come to this country and be an American citizen. And it never goes away. That kind of stance never goes away. We constantly deal with it. Even recently, I went to El Paso and at the airport.
And you know what? I hate to do this to you, Octavio, but I have to cut you off there. The clock has caught us. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for being part of the wonderful cast. And I hope to talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Angie. It was really great being here on Open Air.
Octavio Solis with Retablo's Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border by the fabulous Word for Word. That's Open Air for this week. I've been your host, Angie Cuero. All of our shows are archived at kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles and board engineer D. Minor. Thanks to David Latulippe for letting me sit in this week. Thank you for listening.